You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. Sometimes on the show, I'm going to introduce you to people who I am confident that you have likely never heard of. Other times, my guests may have a slightly higher profile. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Jane Epstein, and I am pretty confident that this will be a totally new, interesting story for you to hear, but she does have a public TEDx talk and a published book, so you're actually going to have to tell me if this is a new story to you or not. Let's do it. Jane Epstein, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Are you ready for a chat?
I am. Thank you so much for having me.
Yay. All right. We are going to talk about some of the changes and choices and decisions that you've made in your life today. But before we jump into that stuff, share with the audience what part of the world you call home.
I am living in Northern California. I've been here for 14 years.
Very, very nice. All right. Another question about you and the kind of things you do about your family specifically, because it comes up in the story you tell later. How many siblings did you have growing up?
I had two siblings, two brothers, two
All
older
right.
brothers.
Two older brothers. All right. Very, very cool. All right. So I'm going to very quickly prep the audience a teeny tiny bit. We're going to talk about some things that might be considered intense, one of which is something called sibling sexual abuse, which is, I think, goes by SSA. And most of the people listening to this are hearing about this topic and you for the first time. So, but this is actually not a huge reveal or an expose. That's not my jam. You have a book and a TED Talk. You talk about this stuff all of the time. Based on what I've done in the research and the information you gave me, I want to check that I understand the timeline. Can we go through that?
Absolutely.
All right. Very good. So at age 20, you were in the entertainment industry as a stripper. Then you were married. Then you were widowed, later remarried, had kids. And in couples counseling, which is a good thing for every single couple, that turned into trauma recovery. And eventually that became going public with your story and becoming an advocate. Did I get that sequence right?
You absolutely did. Yes.
Because you gave it to me. You gave it to me and I was doing the research and I thought, okay, let's just put it all out there and go through it. So before we go too far, because this is your expertise, not mine, I want to give you a second to explain more about what sibling sexual abuse is so that we're all on the same page.
Yes. I talk about sibling sexual abuse and trauma, and only we use the word trauma because each survivor experiences either abuse or trauma. It's however the survivor experiences it. Sibling sexual abuse is a thing. Yes, kids are curious, but there is a line. Experts and researchers are still trying to determine where is that line. I always say that line is up to the victim survivor. Where was that line crossed? What did they experience? It can be, when I talk about sibling sexual abuse, I'm including cousins, older adolescents, child on child. However, my nonprofit, we focus on siblings only, children living under the same household.
Children living under the same household. So when we say siblings, I'll just ask a follow-up question. We would include people that are in an extended family, like kids that are living together, like so half siblings, step siblings, that would all fall probably under
Absolutely.
The same kind of umbrella.
Yes.
Yeah, because the words we use to describe our family can get complicated in these modern times. They sure can. All right. Thank you for talking about that, because I have paid attention to the things you've done, you've shared. And I know that this is something that deserves more attention. It's not spoken about as much as it should be. So because you talk about your story openly and publicly, one of the things that I want to talk about is one of the early decisions you made when you were 20 years old. And before I ask this question, I just want to tell the audience and you, just so that everybody knows, I don't make any value or moral judgments about people who are in the entertainment industry, any part of it, or any job that anybody has at any point, right? Including, you know, a wide variety of things. But when you were 20, you went into the entertainment industry and you were a stripper. Do you remember some things that were going on at that time in your life when you were 19 and 20? And what are the things that led into making that decision for yourself?
Right. As a survivor of sibling sexual abuse and trauma, I was exposed to sexual feelings very early on. And I became very promiscuous, transactional. I desired, I needed male attention to feel okay about myself. And I was just drawn to the stripper stage. It just threw me in. I just needed to get on that stripper stage.
Okay. That is fair. So that is very interesting. So when you were 20, you had finished high school. Was this like your first job or had you had other jobs?
I had had other jobs and I barely graduated from high school because I was drinking, I was doing drugs, and I had actually started going to business college, but the lure of male attention was just too strong.
Okay. And did you thinking back to, well, actually I'll come to that later. So I'm gonna leap no, actually, I'll do. Thinking back to that time when you were 20, because now you've got a lot of expertise and a lot of recovery and knowledge and things. But when you were 20, before you had all the therapy and all those things, were you aware and thinking about the events of your childhood and how they might be impacting your decisions or not?
I was not.
Yeah.
I really had put it in the back. It was in the back of my brain. I didn't forget everything. There's blips, but in my brain, I had put it in the back of my brain that no, that was just two kids being curious. I'm not messed up over that. I'm a tough girl. I'm a tough party girl.
Okay.
I hadn't put the two together. No.
So when you were making the decision of going into entertainment, would you have been able to say then that you knew you were attracted to the male gaze and male attention, or was it just, I like this and it seems like a great way to make money?
I think it was both. It was
Okay.
definitely a great way to make a good income, a cash income at the time. And but I just had this strong desire to prove myself, to prove that I was pretty, to have the male attention. I just can't explain, but it just felt like this might sound kind of crazy to some of your listeners, but it felt like it was meant to be.
Well,
And it actually did serve me well.
and that's actually what I wanted. That's the part of the story that I wondered if it was there, and I wanted to give it a chance to come up because sometimes when we look at other people's decisions that we don't understand or we maybe don't agree with, or they seem like they're not on the path to success, right? We think that. We forget to that probably the piece of person made that decision because it was the best decision and it served them well at the time. Even though, with more knowledge or a different experience, different set of facts.
Right. And it's actually a part of my life that I look back on with, there was a lot of growth. And the person that I went stripping with, she's called Stephanie in the book. We are still connected. And we both kind of look back at that time quite fondly. We grew a lot during that period of time. We really did. So I do think it was meant to be. I think it was part of my story. It was meant to be written.
No,
Yeah.
absolutely. Yeah, no, and it's yeah, I hear it. Okay, so I'm gonna leapfrog a little bit forward in the story. You share in your TED Talk that the abuse came up in couples counseling with your second husband, and I was curious because there's some stuff in between then, whether or not you had done therapy and stuff like that, if you were talking about it with your first husband and before this, or the whole time, if maybe you were following the age-old method of survival by completely ignoring the elephant in the room.
I was completely ignoring the elephant in the room. I had not discussed it with my previous husband. I just kept putting it back in the corner, putting it back in the box, saying, that's not my problem. It's got to be something else that's making me unhappy. It's not that.
Oh my, that's, I think that's very interesting. I think that's very interesting. So your first marriage, how long was your first marriage?
We were together about 12 years. We were married 7 years before he passed.
And then you were a widow at
Yes.
about 35-ish.
30, 34, 35, yes.
That's a big deal also.
It is a big deal.
Yeah.
Yes. But
So.
again, it was part of my story and a part of my story that I would not rewrite. It was actually a very beautiful gift.
But what makes you say describe it as a gift?
Well, he did rescue me from the stripper stage. He did. And he taught me how to dress. He taught me how to socialize. And when he was sick, I had to surrender, and I had no control. And when he passed, the best way I can describe it is I had been living in denial and disassociation for so long that I was numb. But when he passed, I had no choice but to feel the pain. And so I felt alive for the first time in my life, and I felt joy. I don't know if you've talked with anyone about grief, but there is joy inside of grief. And I grew so much, and I appreciated the small things. And actually being able to take care of someone that you love so deeply and being able to experience that process with them, and I was there when he passed, it was actually really very beautiful. Very painful, but very beautiful.
Okay, I love that you have reframed that as in that way. That is amazing. I mean, grief is complicated. Grief is
Yes.
complicated. So, but even still, you're going through grief. Grief is a time, bereavement and grief like that is a time where often people do find themselves to self-help and therapy and the support. But even through this, you're just dealing with the grief. You're ignoring everything else that has not completed
Yes.
the cycle. Okay, how long between and then you decided this is another decision. You decided to get married again. So was that something that was you thought you would do or surprised you, or just how did that come about?
I actually started seeing a therapist prior to my husband's death, thinking I
Okay.
could outrun grief. It didn't work, by the way. And I told
It
her
was a
that,
good
I was
plan.
kind of, it was a good plan. I had a plan.
I did that with couples counseling. I was like, if we go now before we get married, then what we will do is we will never have any problems while we were married. That was
Right.
also it didn't work, but it was a decent plan.
It's a good plan. So I started seeing her, and I had this. Because I knew he was terminal, and I felt so much guilt about, well, I'm kind of looking forward to a new start. I'm at 34 years old, and I get to start over. I get to get remarried. It's kind of cool. And she explained to me that, you love being married, and by getting remarried, you're kind of honoring marriage. You liked being married. It's okay to want to get married again. So I did want to get married again. I made that decision, and then I had a decision in my mind that I would prefer to be a mom. I didn't really want to be a stepmom, but I also knew that my options may be what they may be. And yeah, I made a decision that I wanted to get married and have children.
Very nice. So that is very interesting that it was on purpose. You had that conscious decision to you were honoring your love of the relationship, and you wanted to find somebody that was willing to have kids for the first time with you.
That was my hope. Yes.
That was your hope. And
And
did you find that? You did
I
find
did
it. All
find
right.
it. I did
Very
find it,
cool.
yes.
All right. So then, being a mom often, or and actually a stepmom, I went through this with. I'm a stepmom and a mom. And so it was, but seeing kids and seeing them go through milestones has the often very surprising impact of reminding us our own childhood. So,
Yes.
yeah. So, when did, how old were your kids when this started to pop up into your memory that things had?
Well, it was kind of a culmination of things. First of all, I did have unresolved grief because I went into my second marriage relatively quickly. And so I
Okay.
had unresolved grief, and that was kind of creeping up. And then I had two children back to back. They're a year and a week apart, and who knows what hormones were playing. And I
Oh,
was
all of them.
angry, and I was all of them. I was angry, and I was depressed. I was just kind of raging. And my now marriage, at the time, it wasn't perfect. It's still not perfect. It's very good, but it's still not perfect because we are human. But I was raging, and I just kept pushing it down and pushing it down. And my children were about 2 and 3, and something happened within my marriage that brought back a memory to the surface that refused to go back down.
So that is really interesting. Now, when that happened, because we don't, I mean, we there's a huge, we don't have, we have tons of memories from childhood that we don't focus on all of the time. And the other thing is that memories are tricky, right? Like, so,
Yes.
memories are tricky. And so when something comes up, when you're thinking back to, your fifth birthday party or Christmas when you're seven, it's who knows how reliable it is what we're remembering. But when this happened, like how did it feel? Did you feel like certain that this had happened, or were you unsure what you were remembering? Like how was the experience? Because you were tired, two kids under
Three,
3 years old, you were exhausted.
yes,
Yeah, and hormonal and trying to get, like trying to figure, yes, all of those things. But how did
yeah.
it feel?
Because I'd had this nagging memory in my head for my whole lifetime. It never fully went away, and my older sibling had apologized to me when I was 21. I knew it had happened. I knew it was a real memory, and it was also the memory that had caused me the most shame. So I knew it was the real thing, but in the past I'd been able to push things down, but this time it was not going down.
So, and one of the things that I think, and I don't, this, I'm sure this is in your book and we'll tell people how to get your book, but I'm curious about the relationship between you and your siblings when you were an adult and building your own life and you had these little fragments of the memories that were you were either ignoring or they were surfacing. Were you still like in regular contact with your parents and your siblings and, you know, family barbecues and holidays?
Yes, I was. I was in regular contact, and it didn't rear its full ugly head until the depression hit me so deeply. And I was very, very angry, and I started shutting everybody out. My father passed before I started really processing the memories. So I just tried shutting everybody out, but it was there, and it kind of culminated almost serendipitously because when the memories resurfaced and they wouldn't go away, and I started becoming angry, we actually moved across the country, my husband and I. And so it created that distance.
Yeah, the
So I've
geographic
probably only
distance.
seen the sibling that sexually abused me. I've only seen them once since the memories really came back at full force. So that's actually been very convenient for me.
Yeah, no, definitely. When we talk about boundaries, that's definitely one that comes in handy, like actually putting space between people if there's like a challenge. You know, it's not always possible, but I remember one time getting advice from somebody about how to like stop a fight with my stepdaughter, right? And he was like, well, walk away. Like, just, you know, you don't have to engage. And I was like, this is an option. What are you talking about? This is an option. So, like, he's like, walk into the other room. And then that only partially works because they can follow you. But
Yes, they can.
across the country, that's a bigger geographic boundary and it gives you some ability to create actual space and distance for yourself.
Yes.
So, how much time has passed since you began to process this and entered into therapy and to now to today?
Wow, I started processing it when I was about 45. I'm 56 now. And I started really working hard on it in 2017. That's when I
Okay.
started writing it down and getting it out of my system.
Writing to and working with a therapist and going through.
Yeah, because we'd been in marriage counseling probably about 5 years before I finally divulged this secret to my husband.
Which I
And
gotta say, that's like a
yeah.
bombshell. Like I am trying to imagine this like conversation in the therapist's office, and you know, it's like, you know, you're fighting about the tooth, who's squeezing the toothpaste in the middle of the tube, and then you're like, hello, bombshell. The reason I'm
Yes.
mad is not actually about the toothpaste, but here.
Yes. I've definitely dropped several bombshells on my husband for sure. Because he actually helped me proofread my book and he's reading and he said, "You never told me this. You never told me this." I'm like, "Tell you anything." So, yeah, that it honestly would have happened with the therapy. How that came about was we had been in th therapy for about 5 years and I was still unhappy and no one could figure out why I was unhappy. So I actually had to make the decision to go dig inside of myself. And I decided, fine, I'm going to turn over every single hurt and I'm going to write it down. I'm going to figure out what is going on with me. And it was at that point that it was really revealed to me that, okay, maybe this had a bigger impact on my life than I realized. And that's when I told the therapist one-on-one about it. And he said, you need to tell your husband. And I said, I don't want to tell my husband. And he said, no, you need to tell him. So that's how that
Oh, so
came
it was
about.
not in the scene that I had made for
Yeah.
in my mind. It was like the two of you guys on the couch, like going through counseling, and you it was like a momentary, well, there is this other thing that's bothering me, but it was
Well,
not
it
that.
kind of was. It was
Okay.
that I had that moment on my own. I had that thing thinking, well, maybe it's this. And I started writing it down and thinking, well, maybe it's this. So I did make an appointment with the counselor and I said, you know, there is one other thing. And I remember approaching him thinking, this can't be that big of a deal because I felt like I was complicit in the abuse. I felt like I had asked for it on some level. And I thought it was my brother. It wasn't a neighbor down the street. It can't be that big a deal. And he looked at me and he said, no, this is a big deal. And I said, yeah, but you know, I was complicit. And he said, no, that's a feeling that you had. You couldn't consent at age six. So it was kind of an aha moment for everyone. And yeah, it was kind of a big bombshell for my husband.
Well, and you, I think, I mean, you were actually, there's a moment. Okay, so there's a choice there. There's several choices you made.
Yes.
One is to be honest with yourself and to let these things bubble up in your journals. And the next is to tell somebody else, which actually is an enormous point of vulnerability, and I don't know whether or not you had tried to tell people about this when you were a kid or not, but it is a very big deal to tell somebody else that you have this that's happened. And there's a pretty big piece of luck here that you, it sounds like you were talking to a therapist who had a very strong skill set to be able to meet you where you were and walk you through that. Because this is, you know, this is a specialty kind of thing. And so that's pretty lucky.
Yes, I agree because I have heard from other survivors and therapists will tell them, hey, you know, kids are curious. This happens all the time. So fortunately, I wasn't, I had the right therapist for that point in my life.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, it's very innocuous things like they'll ask you to retell episodes or they'll say, "Are you sure that that's
Are
really
you
right?
sure?
Are you sure?"
Yes.
And people, you know, people think that that's a very supportive thing, but when you've got somebody who's really trying to face something hard, that that can be the nail in the coffin to send it back into like, "I'll never talk about
Yes.
it again." So,
Right.
yeah. So then you were dealing with you were very young when these memories were formed. There's a sibling relationship. He's older than you, which is a power relationship. They're both older than you. You're the youngest person in the family. So you're the
Yes.
bottom of the control dynamic in this family and you do this. How when did you talk to, I mean, you've talked to your sibling. He had apparently talked to you before you were ready to face it. That has to
Right.
have been, how was that?
Wow, because I was about 21 and I went to go visit him, and he and his wife had just had a child, and she went to go take care of the baby. And he said to me, "I'm sorry for what I did to you when you were little." And I had this response of, What did you do to me when you were little?" And then I remembered, and I said, my response was, "It's okay, I participated." That's what I said. That's
Yeah.
all I was capable of at the time. However, knowing that he apologized to me, I think I had that in my back pocket for the next 25 years until I was able to process it. Just knowing, okay, he's admitted what he did. He's not just living his best life thinking nothing happened. So I had that advantage that I don't take that lightly. Not many people get apologies.
I yeah no but then he but he did not come back and say, "Well, no, you I didn't give you a choice as to whether or not to participate." So
He
you
did
were
not.
carrying that as that was set in stone. Like, yes, we agree that we were both there. That's yeah, no, I'm trying to think if my brother came to me and was like, "I'm sorry for what I did." The long list of sibling things, like, you know, you made me eat your Brussels sprouts, like, you know, all of the twerpy things we do to our siblings, you know, that he would have the that you guys would know, that you guys would know intuitively what it was. Do you think when you look back on the family dynamics? Now, as an adult and having worked through it, can you see how this may have impacted how you guys were functioning as a family from 6 to 20? Or was it not?
I think I want to make sure I understand your question. I'm going to try and answer it this way. So many people think that sibling sexual abuse and trauma happens only in dysfunctional families. First of all, I don't know any family that's not dysfunctional.
Right,
That's
it
the
is a
first
funny
thing.
word, right?
There are certain things that can happen within a family that makes sibling sexual abuse and trauma more likely. And my family was one of those. And that, looking back, I can see how that happened. My father was very adamant that he didn't want a third child. Then I came along and I'm a girl, and he wasn't sure what to do with a girl. He was a school psychologist. He was basically rescuing all the other children and not focusing on what was happening in his own home. He was very controlling, and my mother was unhappy. They were not functioning as a functional family. It wasn't a functional marriage. There was distance, and I was not daddy's little girl. So when my sibling, who is very logical child, had questions and was curious, and I know these things because I've actually asked him. I said, why did you do this? And thinking that he would say, well, I was sexually abused, I thought that would be his answer. But his answer was, I had questions and I was curious, and I saw you getting undressed, and I decided to get you alone. And then his body responded, and he decided he wanted more. And then there's me, who's wanting attention, who's wanting to be daddy's little girl. And that made me more susceptible to the abuse. So yeah, we were a dysfunctional family. I'm textbook for this type of abuse.
Okay. So, but did you, would you say that you had a close relationship with your siblings? That's, I mean, that sounds like a judgment, but would you say that you had a strong relationship with your siblings growing up? or did you were you distant?
Let me explain it to you this way, and this has kind of been told to me. I'm not sure that I recall it. I was the annoying little sister who came years later. There is a big
Okay.
age
Oh, there's a
gap.
big age
There's
gap.
this,
Okay.
yeah, there's 6 years for my oldest sibling and 4 years for my middle sibling. First of all, I want to go on record and say that my middle sibling has nothing to do with any of this. But their view of me was, a spoiled little girl. So I wanted to be loved and accepted by them. But I think, as I was a typical annoying sister.
Right. And well, the stereotype of that is that the youngest kid is the loudest, right? Because they're
Was
fighting to
loud.
be heard and that kind of thing. And so there's a piece of that that, sometimes people can turn into, dynamics. But yeah, so that's it. I'm just feeling it out because I do think it's interesting to think about because what we grow up with, right, is normal. To a certain degree, like it doesn't stand out if it doesn't stand out as abnormal until you have something to compare it to. So,
Right.
like if you grow up in a city, you just know that that's the only thing you know. If your family is vegetarian, you have no idea that there's anybody out there that doesn't have a life like that until something happens that shows you. And so that's, I was just curious about that. So your dad passed away before a lot of this happened. So, did you ever talk to your parents about this, or was this something that you mostly came public with after they were not there?
I did share with my mom at some point. I want to say I was about 24, and the only words I had were, my sibling messed with me. And she understood what I was saying. And she cried and she said, "Where was I? How did this happen? I tried to do all the right things." And then she had to go on her own healing journey, feeling guilty for not knowing. So she won. I'm very fortunate. She believed me. She acknowledged it.
Right.
Yeah, but then that was when I was 24, and again, then I kind of put it back in the box. And then when I started wanting to go public or needing to go public, then she started giving me pushback and telling me that I needed to forgive and what about him and his family? And we had to go through another back and forth and process there.
Well, I'm going to ask you about going public now, and we're going to talk about that because you could have leaned into your own personal recovery and in your family and done all of these things and not gone public. And it definitely is, in the self-help world, many people who are helpers do build from their own original story, but it is a play. If you want to get your family's attention, tell them you're writing a book about your family. They will. They're gonna stand up and pay attention. And so like talk me through like where how like so it took a couple years, and what was the first little niggle that was like, I wanna bring this out. I'm gonna move towards advocacy.
Sure. I had started writing my story down because there was something inside of me or someone that was going to die inside if I didn't get it out. So I knew that I had to be heard on some level. So I started writing it down on the page. And then I started Googling sibling sexual abuse and trauma, and I couldn't find anything. Google was literally almost silent. That's not the case today, thank goodness. But what was that, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, I started writing. It took me 7 years to write the book. I started Googling and there was nothing out there. And I thought, I am not the only one. I know I'm not the only one. And so at that point, I actually reached out to my sibling and I said, I have to raise awareness to this. This is something that needs to be talked about. In all honesty, I kind of started talking about grief. I can talk about grief because that's my thing. I understand grief well. And then I thought I can talk about child sexual abuse just in general. I can do that. But then I kept getting the nudge that said, no, you need to go deeper. You need to talk about sibling. And I thought, oh, hell no. I am not going to talk about that. That is just too much shame. Now today it just rolls off my tongue so easily and I forget that the society in general is like, ugh. But for me it's something that I'm able to talk about comfortably. So I just had this desire, this drive inside of me that knew I had to talk about it. And I just kept getting the tap on the shoulder. And anytime I wanted to quit, another survivor would reach out to me or another parent would reach out to me. And even those who had caused the abuse started reaching out to me. So I knew I needed to keep going and keep writing the book. And I didn't know for sure if the book would ever be published. I just knew I needed to write it down.
7 years. Writing a book is a very slow process. It takes,
Yes.
it seems like it's just, it's one of those things that it doesn't, it's even when you're in it and you're going through it, it doesn't actually seem to make sense why it moves so slowly. I mean, publishing is instant almost,
Yes.
I mean, and it still, it takes forever. So you said, so your husband read it,
Yes.
and there, and that was probably a big moment. That I'm handing him a manuscript and saying, "Here you go." How did that feel?
Yes, because sometimes I'd have to hand him a chapter and I'd say, just this is a little heads up, this is a tougher chapter to read. And it was hard for him because he wanted to ask me questions. And I would say, no, I can write it, but I can't talk about it yet. I can still write it, but I can't talk about it. And he'd have all these unresolved questions. Now, over the course of 7 years, all his questions have been answered and I can actually talk about things more now. But he's actually, my mother reading the book and my husband reading the book, they were the two scariest people to have that book in hand.
Yeah, it's a little bit like turning your body inside out and wearing your nerves on the outside. It's like I want everybody to read it, and also I'm terrified.
Yes.
So what was what were you afraid of? What was the fear when you gave it to them? What were you afraid that they'd do?
Well, there are times in the book where my husband and I, we had a tough time. We struggled in a marriage, and it in our marriage it takes two. But I came into the marriage with a lot of trauma, and I have a temper. I go from 0 to 60. And for a long time, I was seeing him in a very bad light. And I had to own up to that within the book. And yet he's not perfect either. So I couldn't write him as perfect in the book. So he's very exposed out there. I mean, his friends are reading this book. So that was really scary to me. And it was also scary to me too, because he had to read about my late husband. And then he also had to read about, my transactional relationships. I was very promiscuous. He had to read all that. And that's hard on a spouse.
So that 0 to 60, that's a pretty common trauma response.
Yes,
I'm
it's one I can't
responding
seem to lose.
outsized. Yeah. Right. An outsized response to the situation. Good morning. Yes, that's the one that rears its ugly head. So you were writing the book for 7 years, but you were also interacting with people. You were getting feedback from victims and feedback overall. How did that happen? When you start speaking, or what was going on that was connecting you to the advocacy work? Because it doesn't sound like there was an organization. So how did that happen?
There was not an organization at the time. So I started a Facebook page, a business Facebook page, and I just started posting things. And I wouldn't get much interaction on the page, but people would start sending me DMs. And then I started an Instagram page, and same thing. I started getting more interaction on Instagram because people can hide under their handle. And then I really found my people on TikTok because, again, they can be anonymous under these names, no picture. So I started hearing from more and more people, and I thought, we really need to sound the alarm. We've got to sound the alarm. So I actually started pitching the media, and the media just completely ignored me, which I understand. But I was trying to shout, and people don't like to be screamed at. So that's actually how I ended up getting on the TEDx stage, because I thought, well, fine, if the media is going to ignore me, then I'm going to try and land a TEDx talk. And because I was so out there, and so, started doing podcasts. I had a parent reach out to me, and she goes under pseudonym Brandy Black. She reached out to me and she said, "Look, I discovered this in my home and I couldn't find anything about it. So during COVID, I wrote my own website and I would like a survivor to read over it." So that's how I met Brandy. And in the meantime, I'd met another survivor. So that gave us three. And through my advocacy, I'd heard from parents. So I had found two other parents who wanted to be involved. And that's how 5waves.org was built. And now there is a website called siblingsexualtrauma.com that Brandy authored. So now there's actually an organization that talks about sibling sexual abuse and trauma. And honestly, in the UK, they're doing more studies. The US is behind. But now when you go to Google, Google's not silent. It's amazing.
That is really amazing. So social media and the internet, they get thrown under the bus all the time as being like the cause of many, many bad things. But one of the really great things about so many pockets of information is what you're talking about, is that in that moment where you're like, oh, am I the only one who's ever, experienced this? Like, what is this? And you search and you can be connected with other people with a similar experience, whether that's a hobby or something, completely different, like a personality. That is one of the real blessings of the connectivity of the internet.
I agree. I agree. I've connected with so many survivors over the internet.
That is very good.
Yeah.
All right. So now, in a minute, we're going to do the final rapid fire questions, but I want to give you a chance to tell people about the ways that people can reach you. So you mentioned the organization, fiveways.org, and you've got a memoir. Tell people all about the places they can find you and interact.
Absolutely. I think the best place if you need resources, if you're a parent or if you're a person who's caused harm or abuse, or if you're a survivor, email us at info@fivewaves.org and either a parent or a survivor will respond to you. I am on Instagram at Jane_Epstein author. I'm on TikTok, Jane Epstein author. But probably if you really want to connect with me, DM me on Instagram or email me. My book is called I Feel Real Guilty. It is available on Amazon, either paperback, ebook. It's even available on Audible, and it's also available on Barnes and Noble and bookshop.org.
All right, and you gave me a link that I'll include in the show notes and in the email that goes out
Great.
to everybody about this so that that's easy for people to find.
Great.
It's a lot of work to do all of that, and I don't think this was an easy journey for you, but I'm glad that you did it and you were here to share that with us. Okay, so, and I'll put the link to your TED Talk as well. Okay, so we end with three questions. So the idea is that you answer them with short little answers, two or three words. They're just for fun. They're not related to anything else. No pressure so far. Nobody has made it all the way through with just two to three words. I'm usually the problem. I have more to say than the guests, but let's give it a shot. Are you ready?
Okay. Yeah, I'm
All right.
ready.
So do you like pizza? And if so, what is your perfect pizza topping combination?
I love pizza. Perfect combination is jalapenos and pineapple.
Oh my goodness, I'm so glad I asked. Because usually the question is, what do you feel about pineapple on pizza? Because people have a strong preference. Pineapple, and I can see that pineapple and jalapeno.
Yes.
Like you put like a spicy margarita on your pizza, combining
Yes.
Mexican and Italian flavors all in one profile. I love it. That's great. Okay. Do you consider yourself a morning person or a night owl?
Morning person.
Very cool. And now, last one. What is the most beautiful or memorable place you've ever traveled or been? And you can only pick one.
Oh, that one's hard. I'll say Cinque Terre, Italy.
Oh, I have not been there, but the photos of that make me want to go all the time, all the time. There's so many places in Italy. Like there's just all the things. But every time that comes up on like the screensaver on like a television or a computer, I'm like, ah, that looks so nice. So
Can't go wrong with
nice.
Italy, anywhere in Italy. You can take me anywhere in Italy and I'll be happy.
Yeah, and that's the it's like there's so much to do that you can, it's like it's a big time commitment to do all of them. But you know what? That's fine. Go back, go back, go back, go back. All right. Thank you very much. That's it, Jane Epstein. Thank you for being a wonderful guest on The Art of Imperfect Adulting.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.